On weekends, we're typically off on another adventure. Whether it's a scenic hike or a quaint town visit, I keep my Vessies with me because they effortlessly adapt to every twist and turn, ensuring comfort and style in our sometimes spontaneous escapades. Whether it's with the kids or just my husband and me, which is pretty rare, I love stepping into a great outdoor adventure with Vessies Stormburst boots to capture the beauty of springtime landscapes. Their robust style is perfect for our nature excursions, adding a little dash of elegance to our outdoor explorations. The Vessi collection caters to every style. Whether you're dressing up for a night out or gearing up for a weekend hike, these shoes seamlessly blend into your wardrobe while offering the practicality of waterproof footwear. Ready to refresh your spring wardrobe? Vessi has you covered with footwear that fuses style with practicality. Head over to vessi.com/outside to explore their versatile collection and automatically claim your 15% discount on your first order upon checkout. That's vessi.com/outside for 15% off your first order. Okay, you ready?
Yes.
Welcome to the 1000 Hours Outside podcast. My name is Jenny Erich. I'm the founder of 1000 Hours Outside, and I have the author of a book that I absolutely love called The Nature Fix here with us today, Florence Williams. Welcome.
Thank you, Jenny. Great to be here.
This is like the perfect book for our audience. The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. Who doesn't want that, right?
Right.
And it's very comprehensive. In this book, you go through, I'm like, how could there even be this much to talk about? And it's just thing after thing after thing, just incredibly well-researched. And a book that's really going to get you outside. You're a journalist, contributing editor to Outside Magazine. You've been a New York Times, National Geographic. You lead incredible retreats, Nature Fix retreats. People can find those at florencewilliams.com. Before we go any further, I want to know a little bit more about those. Tell us about a Nature Fix retreat.
Sure. Well, I do a few every year, mostly in the summer in Colorado. And they're really sort of based on the science in the book. So we try to really focus on finding awe and experiencing what happens when we see awe and beauty in terms of, a shift in our perspective, less kind of negative thought cycling, less rumination, more being present and mindful, awakening our sensory bodies. And then, you know, really going a little bit deeper even into how we can rewrite the narratives of our future. You know, who do we want to be? Being in nature, I think, especially the wilderness, which is where we go for 3 days, can really make us think about who we are and where we want to go from here. You know, and what is our purpose on this planet? There's something about experiencing awe that lets us kind of rewrite that story.
So do you find people come in from all over the country? They come in from mainly the Colorado area. I would imagine you've met a lot of people.
People come in from all over the country. And I think part of what attracts them is the work I've done in the Nature Fix, but also my most recent book is called Heartbreak, A Personal and Scientific Journey. And it's about how I recovered from the divorce of a 25-year marriage by going into nature and by experiencing awe. So it's really kind of, it goes a little bit deeper into grief and trauma than the Nature Fix does.
Mm-hmm. Wow, so many resources, so many great resources. Okay, let's talk about some of the things in this book that, you know, and I've been reading about this stuff for a long time, and there were things in this book I've never heard of. I'm like, this is so fascinating. So a couple of things that we could talk about that are great for us as parents, as adults, and also great for our kids is that these simple sensory experiences do so much for us. And I think that was an overarching theme throughout your book. It was like this little thing, you know, this little smell. And one of the ones was, and I don't even know if I know how to pronounce it. Geosmin?
Oh, geosmin, yeah.
Okay, so this is, I've heard the word, but I've never actually heard it pronounced. It's the smell of earth after a rain. And it says we can detect the equivalent of 7 drops of geosmin in a swimming pool. I mean, it just, that's like this theme. It's like a little bit, just a little bit, and you can detect it. So one of the things that you talk about is how our sense of smell, it really is affecting how we live, how we feel. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I was so fascinated to learn this from the researchers. And by the way, the researchers are funny because they all have a different theory for why we feel so good outside. If you talk to people who care about color, the psychologist will say, oh, it's the color green that makes us feel a certain way. Or no, it's actually the bird song that makes us feel a certain way. But the people who study the nose, I think, have a really good argument, which is that when we smell something, our nose is like this direct pathway into our brain. It doesn't have to go through another, kind of perceptual structure, to get interpreted. And so it's this direct pathway. It can instantly alter our mood. Psychologists take advantage of this when they consult retail stores, for example, that if you missed the smell of like citrus in a shop, you'll be more likely to spend money. Because you feel kind of more optimistic and you feel a little less stressed out. So we can also take advantage of that for our own mental health. So what I do is when I'm going for a walk, when I see an evergreen tree or a shrub, even, you can do this in a city, there's ornamental shrubbery, you can sort of like secretly, pick off a little needle. And if you crumble it and smell it, and put it up to your nose as you continue your walk, it can just instantly put you into a better mental space. And especially if it's a smell, that you have memories of or that you're fond of. So like for me, I go crazy for ponderosa trees here in Colorado. We have a lot of them. I've been admiring ponderosa trees since my childhood, and so when I pick off a few pine needles and smell it, not only does it just smell good and it kind of helps me feel alive and present in the moment, but it also just takes me back to, something that's kind of sentimental and important to me.
And that's the thing. It's just one pine needle. I mean, it's really amazing.
Pine
And
needle.
your book includes all the science and talks about the terpenes and the limonene. I know you don't even know how to pronounce the words, but your nose can detect at concentrations of 10 parts per trillion. The nose can detect 1 trillion odors. So this is something that really drove home the point that the nose is so much, I think, more powerful than we realize, is that you can actually smell fear.
Yes. So there are experiments in which researchers gave college students, for example, t-shirts that had been worn by other people, and they didn't know them, but some of those other people had been watching, for example, like scary videos, and some of them had been watching mild videos. I think there was even one experiment where skydivers, were asked to wear a t-shirt jumping out the plane, and then they saved those t-shirts and they gave them to other people in these later experiments. And yeah, so we can smell fear, and it kind of makes sense because we have to be able to understand our environment. And we're mammals, we're social mammals, we're used to hanging out, we're used to taking cues from each other. If something scary is happening around the corner, we all kind of need to know about it. We use smells to communicate, we use them to understand the world. And kids love scratch and sniff, it's interactive. When we smell something in our environment, we feel like almost we're having a conversation with it. It's like we can scratch this needle, pine needle, we can smell it. And it's like, oh my God, that is a different feeling than I had, a minute ago.
Yeah, I love scratch and sniff. That's so the truth. I mean, that's fascinating. And then sometimes I wonder who thought of that? Who thought, let's take these t-shirts from these skydivers? And you had wrote that it was their first time skydiving. So it was this special thing, collected the undershirts of men who went skydiving for the first time. And then it said they smelled the terror and caught it so that they felt a little uneasy too. So there's this sense that the smells, we catch them and even the feelings that go along with them. You were talking about women have a better sense of smell than men, and this gets heightened during pregnancy. Why do you think that is?
I think it's because we have to be especially careful when we're pregnant not to get food poisoning, not to ingest bacteria that can harm our fetus. And so we have an extra strong sense of especially disgust when we're pregnant. And that's what, look at morning sickness, right? It's like I couldn't even really eat after about 3 p.m. when I was pregnant. It just all food seemed disgusting to me.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And then you said even when you live in the home and your cycles sync, so like your menstrual cycles sync up or you're in a dorm, And that has to do with smells too. I always
Well,
wondered
I have
about
to
that.
tell you, since I wrote that, actually, that one is now sort of controversial. And there's been
Okay.
later evidence showing that maybe that doesn't happen. Maybe it's just coincidence. So I think maybe the jury's still out on that one.
All right, well, just
I think we all like the idea of it, though.
yeah, so many interesting things about our sense of smell and how much power it holds, which is just a great reminder to get outside. There's so many things out there to smell, the smell that comes after the rain, all of the trees. One of the things that you talked about that was really interesting was the sound piece. And you answered the question for me, which I've always wondered. People always ask, if a tree falls in the woods and no one's there, is there a sound? And what is the final answer?
Well, sound isn't a thing until it gets interpreted by our inner ear and then, sent through our audio nerves to our brain. Before that happens, it's just waves, right? Waves of energy. And so a sound kind of has to be heard and interpreted by some creature's brain in order for it to really exist in the material world. So I thought that was very interesting.
It's kind of mind-blowing, right? If it falls in the woods, there's no sound unless someone or some animal hears it. But you're talking about this sound in relation to, and I've not heard anybody talk about this, Florence, about just human noise. And there was a word for it, anthrophone.
Oh, anthrophony. Yes. So we are very sensitive to noise as humans. It's one of our main alerting senses. When we were like in our deep evolutionary past, asleep in a cave, if there was a bear growling outside, boy, we really needed to wake up fast, right? And respond in order to survive. So our ears are actually one of our strongest alerting senses, and they may be actually the oldest one in terms of how early we develop it. We develop it even in utero, our sort of audio abilities. And yeah, I mean, it's such a powerful sense that it also can really affect our state of mind, our emotional state, our moods. There have been some really interesting studies looking at bird song and showing that when we hear bird song, I think this is so interesting. We immediately feel a little bit calmer and more comfortable because everything must be right in the world if the birds are outside singing. There's no big storm coming. There's no huge predator right underfoot. There's no earthquake about to happen. We can kind of relax a minute because the birds are singing. Everything's okay. And there have been some studies where, like on a trail outside of Boulder, Colorado, normally, on a given week, or on a given day, let's say in the spring, you might hear seven birds. And researchers took those same trails and on some of them, they put in speakers and they played bird song of like 20 birds. And then they asked people to fill out questionnaires. How anxious did they feel? How depressed did they feel? How happy did they feel? And some of them walked on the trails with seven birds, and some of them walked on the trail with 20 birds. And the ones who walked with more birds reported greater reductions in stress and anxiety.
Huh. Yeah. So these simple things, the bird song. And even if you just are hearing it, it's not even real. I mean, it is real, but it's not happening from the actual birds. Well, then one of the things that you talked about that I thought was really intriguing was this anthrophony, the sound of jets and the things that we're sort of hearing in the background that everyone just sort of says, oh, you just get used to it, but that those increased decibel levels can actually affect our health. Can you tell us how that works?
Well, just as bird song makes us feel comfortable and relaxed, the anthrophony, which is the sounds of the human-made environment, tends to be very mechanical, and loud. The sounds of traffic, the sounds of airplanes, the sounds of garbage trucks outside our door. They actually, like I said, they increase our alerting sense, and so they cue the fear centers in our brain to wake up and pay attention. They create hypertension in our
Wow.
cardiovascular system because we are supposed to be paying attention to those sounds in case they are a giant gorilla,
Yeah.
or a bear outside our cave. And so we know that people who, for example, live underneath major airports or live near major airports have a greater need for heart medication. They have a higher incidence of stroke and cardiovascular disease. And we know that kids who go to school near freeways and highways where there's high decibel levels of human-made sound, they are behind their peers on measures of reading and math. So they don't learn as well when they're surrounded by these kind of stressful sounds in the environment.
That's really interesting. And then when you say the amount of flights have just increased substantially, 25% since 2002, 30,000 commercial jets fly overhead every day. You were talking about even that it should probably it should impact real estate values, but it doesn't because no one's really talking about it.
Yeah.
I was wondering if, you know, in some homes we have the TV on all day. And this was a big statement. Significant impacts on reading comprehension, memory, and hyperactivity have these linear results. So when there's a 5 decibel increase in noise, reading scores dropped to a 2-month delay every 5 decibel increase. So would that include something like having a television on in the background or something like that?
I don't know if a TV in the background has been studied as much as just, you know, kind of ambient background noise, you know, in school settings. But it would make sense to me that especially if you're listening to TV shows that have a lot of loud, you know, sort of stressful sounds, again, those mechanical sounds or, you know, sounds of, you know, people being shot or, you know, whatever it is, video right. games, they really do increase our nervous system activation in a way that is not so healthy. But, you know, the opposite is true, too, which is that if you live in a neighborhood that has a lot of traffic noise, you can play birdsong. You know, if you close the windows, you can play birdsong. You can give the kids maybe headphone on very soft volume. And it can help relax your kids to play the sounds of waterfalls, birdsong, you know, wind. Some kids might find that, in fact, very relaxing. It might be worth trying.
Well, that's a really good idea, Florence, because you can actually even do that over the television. So sometimes at the holidays, we do like a crackling fire.
Play,
and it just feels really great. Well, that's really good idea. So people could actually measure the decibel levels too, because there's, you were talking about an app on your phone.
Yeah.
So if it's a 5 decibel increase in noise, this is affecting the reading delays and different things. People can learn about this more in your book. But I thought, well, that would be a worthwhile thing, you know, a fun thing to do with your kids. It's just to hear the little bit of decibel difference. And then, like you said, if you could just swap, right? Instead of hearing this type of noise, let's swap.
Mm-hmm.
I loved even this. I thought you wove so many things in here, right? You're weaving in these little things that you can do, this information that people may not know. And then just with all of the nature pieces, like there was such a beautiful paragraph about the brown thrasher can sing 2,000 songs. The cowbird has 40 different notes. The Australian lyrebird is the world's best mimic. The melodic hermit thrush sings on mathematic substrate. That, I mean, it's so interesting. All of these different things. So the wind, the water, the birds, we love music and the voices of our loved ones. So just giving a little bit more thought to what we're listening to and really realizing that there are not that many quiet places on Earth anymore, certainly not in the continental U.S. You had talked about there's only a couple.
Yeah. Yeah, it's astonishing. There are very few places in the continental United States where you can sit for, I think it's 15 minutes and not hear planes overhead or road noise, you know, coming in from somewhere. And the same is true actually with darkness. So just as there aren't a lot of quiet places left, there aren't a lot of places left in the US where you can actually see the night sky, you know, the way our ancestors saw it. I know that a lot of kids who grow up in cities and suburbs today have never seen the Milky Way. You know, you need a really dark sky to see that. And so imagine how astonishing it is to take your kids, you know, somewhere dark where they can experience this. Or if, you know, if they belong to a scouting group, you know, they might be able to experience that, you know, with some kind of organization if your family's not able to do it. And, you know, what an incredible experience that is for a kid to see for the first time those stars, you know, and to feel that sense of awe, that sense of being kind of this little grain of sand in the universe, and how special, you know, we are to be on this one planet that is perfect for us. Mm-hmm. I've seen kids experience that, and it's just really fun to watch their little minds get blown in this exciting way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that and the quiet. Paul Bogard has been on our podcast, and he wrote a book called The End of Night, and he talks quite a bit about that. And it's a similar sentence to yours where you say there's only a few fewer than a dozen sites where you can't hear human-made noise for at least 15 minutes at dawn. That's like so specific too, isn't it, Florence? Like, it's not even in the middle of the day. It's just at dawn for 15 minutes. Fewer than a dozen places in the entire continental U.S. That's a big deal. So something to pay attention to, something that's interesting. Students listening to birdsong were more attentive after lunch than students who didn't listen. So I think this is something that we should be talking about as adults, and great for our kids too.
Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. In springtime, allergies can sometimes be my kryptonite. When my nose is plugged up and my eyes are watering, I feel like I struggle more to do the things I really enjoy. Making dinner, heading outside to get my sunlight before noon, and even hosting the show can be a bit more challenging. Luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medication and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for several years, and it's been an absolute life changer. My eyes aren't a constant, itchy, drippy faucet, my nose isn't running, and I can speak without feeling like something has jumped in my throat. And I love that Claritin D tackles nasal congestion caused by allergies or cold, and also relieves sinus congestion and pressure due to allergies. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Use as directed. You know when you get cornered by that one relative at a family gathering and you feel like you have to not give them the full story to avoid even more uncomfortable questions? Well, you may have to grin and bear it with your family sometimes. You shouldn't feel that way when talking to your doctor about that persistent rash your child has or about how many times a week you eat pizza. Enter ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable and actually listen to you. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. And it's not just a couple. We're talking about tens of thousands of doctors, all with verified patient reviews, so you can make sure it's going to be a good fit before you actually head to an office. With ZocDoc, you've got more options than you can imagine. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. No more waiting awkwardly on hold with a receptionist. If I needed this product, it's what I'd use. So go to ZocDoc.com/hours and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/hours. ZocDoc.com/hours.
There was this interesting piece about the fractals. And I wanted to say this because it really connected some things for me. So we'll talk about fractals in a minute, but this is like the sight of nature, fractals. And what was fascinating is that our retinas also move in that same pattern. But this is so wild. I had read, when we're reading on screens in two dimensions, our eyes do not move like that. They move like an L. And it totally changes the way that our eyes move when we're reading on a screen, and they kind of bounce all over and it becomes this more frenetic, there's no pattern to it. And I had no idea that normally there is a pattern to the way that our retinas move. So I guess we could start off with, what is a fractal?
Sure. So a fractal pattern is a pattern that repeats at different scales. So, you know, if you think about looking at a tree, you know, the leaves on the trees have little veins, and then the branches on the trees have similar angles to the way that they're, you know, branching off. Then the bigger limbs of the trees are also sort of going off at similar angles. And then you look at the tree in the forest in the context of other trees, and they're also kind of arrayed in a pattern. So we often see these repeating patterns in nature. We can see them in clouds. We see them in waves or ripples. We see them on coastlines. We see them in rocks. There's something kind of mesmerizing about looking at these repeating patterns. We know from neuroscience studies that our brain waves go into a different state. And I think, I don't know if some of us may recall those screensavers, that we used to have that would sort of move around and wiggle around, and you'd get a little bit kind of mesmerized, and kind of like, ooh, that's sort of relaxing. So fractal patterns are sort of relaxing. They put our brains in a different state. And when we experience them in nature, we feel good.
I thought it was fascinating that our retinas move in that same sort of patterned way, because sometimes we don't know that there's these little things like a two-dimensional screen actually does affect the way that your eyes move versus when you're outside. This was a beautiful sentence. Fractal patterns are often found in nature's roughness. I loved that. In clouds, coastlines, plant leaves, ocean waves, the rise and fall of the Nile River, and in the clustering of galaxies. Okay, so then you did this experiment, because this is like the big thing, which is what if it's virtual reality nature? And this is, we're on the cusp of this, if not kind of already there. So you had done a virtual reality nature experience that made you a little motion sick.
Yeah, because virtual reality isn't really great yet. There's still a little lag between what our eyes see and how our body moves or how our head moves. So it's kind of like being on a boat, where the horizon isn't quite where your body thinks it's going to be because you're on top of a wave. And, these little crystals in your ears get confused. So some people still get seasick looking at virtual reality. It just hasn't really been perfected yet. And I think it's just an example of how we may try to replace time in nature through technology. And we may get some benefits from looking at nature through technology, looking at nature videos, for example, looking at beautiful photographs of the natural world. We may derive some benefits from that, but it's not going to be really the same as when we're in a fully immersive experience where we can smell, what the woods are like, and we can, feel the breeze on our skin and feel the heat of the sun warming our backs. I mean, we are animals, we are sensory animals. We're supposed to move through the world and explore the world through our senses, and children especially, right, discover their worlds through their senses. And yet we put ourselves in these four walled rooms and wonder why we feel so kind of tired and grumpy sometimes.
What an interesting thing. Like, we're just trying, and all this money gets poured into all that stuff where they say, look, if you put on these virtual reality glasses, you ended this book by talking about being together outside. And so the virtual reality glasses not only takes away those sensory experiences, but you said it was like in the acknowledgments. It was something like shared nature is such a great, it says there is no nature like shared nature. So you're giving a shout out to your family and all of these, people that you love. And if you got the virtual reality goggles on, well, that's not a shared nature experience. I mean, I guess it kind of could be. But the other app piece was, okay, this was kind of silly. There was this app that you would take a picture of what you're seeing and it would judge, it would give it a score of whether it's restorative or not, which just seems kind of silly because you think you could just decide for yourself.
Decide for yourself.
But yet somebody made this app.
The app told me that like a snowy mountain view was not pleasant at all because it didn't have enough color and it didn't have enough texture and it was kind of gray. And I was like, but I love looking at a snowy mountain. Like, that's one of my favorite things.
Well, sure.
It didn't take into account kind of personal preferences or history or culture or any of that.
Yeah. If I gave Colorado, that's what you got all the time, those beautiful snowy
That's right.
mountains.
We better
Although
like it.
I do see the other hand where we're in Michigan. So at the end, especially at the end of the winter, it does start to feel sort of dreary. So the person that said there's a difference between something that's pretty and something that's psychologically valuable, but I just found it humorous that there's this app that's going to judge for you. It's going to give you a
Right.
score. Is this going to restore you
Go
or not? I'm
find
like, oh, well, maybe we could figure that out. But this is also affecting our blinking. So when we're having a lot of time on screens, then, well, someone said it was an eye doctor. said to you, you're a starer.
Yeah, we're all starers, I think, when it comes to screens. We just don't blink as often when we're looking at a screen as we do when we're looking at real life. And I'm someone who has pretty dry eyes, and it's not good for your eyes not to blink. Your eyes are meant to blink a lot.
So the little cheat in here, not really a cheat, but the idea is blink 20 times. I thought this is a great sentence. Blink 20 times in a row as often as you can remember. I mean, you don't ever think to blink, really, but if you pay attention a little bit more,
it will help. Just look up, you know, look out the window, look at the middle distance, you know, give yourself these quick little breaks to let your eyes kind of do something else.
Because this is affecting our eyesight, especially for kids. So if we're talking about our kids, how is exposure to sunlight affecting eyesight?
Yeah, I was really fascinated by this. There was all this research coming out showing that kids in parts of Asia had extremely high rates of nearsightedness. They needed glasses. They had myopia. And at first, the theory was that, well, it's because they're doing so much homework, you know, and just looking at books and screens all the time.
Yeah.
But it turns out that it's actually that those kids, especially in Asia, are not getting any time outside. So they don't get recess. They don't get playtime after school. You know, sometimes they go straight to kind of another kind of academic environment where they're learning English or whatever. Mm. And our young eyes need vitamin D in order to elongate the retina properly so that it develops. And in the absence of vitamin D or sunlight, we get all kinds of vision problems. And now, of course, this is happening in the United States as well.
This is important to know. Indoor and outdoor light are totally different beasts. Even on overcast days, everyone always asks this, well, it's cloudy. And that's where we live. It's cloudy for most of the year. Outdoor light is 10 times brighter. So there's two parts of it. The outdoor light is still brighter. Even if it's cloudy, it's rainy, it's dreary, the outdoor light is still brighter than the indoor light. But also it's about the spectrum of the light.
Yes. Yes, much fuller spectrum light outside. So that's great for helping set our circadian rhythms. You know, we want our kids to be able to sleep well at night. We want them to have the right amount of melatonin, you know, getting released from their pituitary gland or wherever it comes from, so that, you know, their hormones develop on the right time scale and so on. And there's nothing like light to trigger our circadian rhythms, which makes sense. So, you know, it's good for us to be outside getting that natural daylight as much as possible. And it's also important for us, as we all know now, you know, to make our rooms dark at night, not to look at screens right before bed, maybe not to use night lights as much for our kids. Or if you do, go for those red tinted light bulbs.
That's really fascinating. And I liked this idea of having glass ceilings over classrooms. I did have a class in high school where it was an interior room. So that poor teacher, I mean, I left, you know, I left during the day to go to other rooms, but that teacher, it was like in a dungeon. Oh. So what a neat idea to have a glass ceiling. I mean, that would do amazing things for kids, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I like that idea. You talked a lot about kids in here. You talked about your own childhood. Well, tell us a little bit about your own childhood. You said your dad would make you these really cool books every year. He would say a limited edition with only one copy.
So I grew up in New York City, actually, which is not, you might think, so close to nature. My parents were divorced and my dad every summer had custody. So he would, we would take this old van. He had this old 1977 Dodge van and we would put some canoes on the top and we would drive out west, you know, to Colorado or Montana. Wow. And we would go camping, you know, for, you know, several weeks.
Wow.
And it was a very special time. I think a lot of my friends in New York thought it was really odd, you know, that I spent so much time in a tent, you know, in the woods in those days, right? But we would come back and every Christmas he would give me, you know, this sort of special book that he would make with photographs from that time. And he would write these kind of sappy paragraphs about how much fun we had.
I think that's really, really special.
It was really sweet.
And that would have been like before Shutterfly, probably. So he's
exactly
making it. It's like a homemade.
This is like the glue sticks and the exactly. And I still have them all.
Ah, specifically written for you. Limited edition, only one copy. I think that's a really cool idea. So you said he taught your love for nature, crossing rivers by jumping rocks, how to steady a canoe. We have kids today that are spending very little time outside. That's really what we're trying to do in our family, is to have a goal for getting outside, because it's easy to stay inside. It's easy to get caught up either in screens or enrichment activities. So like you're talking about going from school to tutoring and, trying to get ready for college and all of that. And so we have kids that are really limited in the amount of time that they're spending outside. So can you talk about what you have learned in terms of how that's affecting our kids? One thing specifically you focused on in this book was ADHD.
One statistic I recently ran across, you may already know this one, is that kids today spend an average of 4 to 7 hours on screens and only 17 minutes outside. So I'm interested in ADHD. There are people in my family, including my son, who had it, and we know that these kids do really well when they're allowed to kind of have some free play outside and run around outside. It helps regulate them, helps them, take in different streams of stimulation, which kids with ADHD are really good at. They kind of thrive when there's a certain amount going on in the environment. I know my son used to love to just pace up and down in the backyard, and he would sort of twirl a drumstick at the same time. That he needed to do a lot of that when he got home from school, just to kind of, I don't know, put his brain in a different state. And I think that so often, in these days, again, we put these kids in a chair in a room, and we give them a pencil or a crayon, and we tell them exactly what to do with it. There's no room for just curiosity or exploration. And in order to help kids do that, we medicate them. And I had this question, and Outside Magazine was really interested in this, and they assigned a story on it, which is that, are we sort of, in some ways, damping down the natural explorer instinct in our species? Right? Because I mean, these ADHD kids in particular, 1,000 years ago, they were the explorers. They were the ones who like went out and found new places to live and found new sources of food and found new trails to, migrate across continents. And now we're saying, oh, no, you need to actually sit still and not be interested by anything outside the classroom. What a loss. I think it's tragic. And so when there are these schools and programs that allow kids to learn more experientially, more curiosity-driven curriculum, I think it's such a wonderful gift.
You hear parents say their ADHD symptoms went away in the summer. And I know that's not true for every child, but it's sort of that. Like there was one sense that said improvement was equal to the difference between having ADHD or not having it. So it's this getting outside piece that helps a lot of kids, because otherwise there's too much structure for them and they're not getting to roam and they're just sitting. So it's really a mismatch, I think, between their biology and what's expected of them. There was an actual school. I was like, well, I wanted to look into it. I mean, it was expensive, but the idea was, it's called SOAR. I don't even know if it still exists, but in North Carolina.
And so this was a program, boarding school for kids with pretty severe ADHD, and also some kids on the spectrum. The idea was that most of the curricula took place outside. So they would learn about the Civil War while backpacking through battlefields. They would learn about geology while climbing rocks in Pennsylvania or West Virginia. They would learn about marine biology while sea kayaking, in the Everglades. And these kids thrived. I mean, they just really turned around. They felt much better about themselves, more self-confidence, more self-esteem, a love of learning. What a gift, right? Just incredible. And it is devastating that these schools are so expensive, because it would be great to have this kind of experience available for everyone. But I think that there are a lot of lessons here, and how schools can be more responsive to kids' curiosity, how they can incorporate longer recess, not shorter recess, more environmental education. Summers are also a great opportunity for parents. If you can afford these nature-based camps, or if you can tap into some community-based programs, where your kids are allowed to kind of just run around a little more and be outside, hopefully where no phones are allowed.
Sure.
You might see these incredible behavioral changes actually in your kids and in their attitudes.
Yeah, we do it just like on our own. We have
Yeah.
five kids. So I had a friend who put her kid in this one. It was sounded amazing, Florence. It was like basically it was like a day camp from, maybe like the 70s. It was like there was all these activities and all these counselors, and you could kayak or you could do bracelets or, I mean, it was all that, all unplugged. I'm like, oh,
Oh.
it was $35 a day. And I was like, oh, nope, I can't. I can't afford that. And so we're just going to have to make do with whatever we can find. But in our area, there's little ponds and places you can swim and creek beds and hills you can climb that we call sand dunes, but they're made out of gravel. And if you just go and stay for a lengthy period of time with a couple friends, the kids really like that. And I think it helps them to feel better. So interesting information in here about ADHD. I know Penn Holderness, I don't know if you know him, but he just came out with a book about ADHD as well. And that SOAR school will just be interesting. I think what you say, though, throughout the whole book is it's little things. So maybe if you're a teacher in a classroom, like throw on the bird song or go outside and do your reading out there or something like that. But it's going to help all these different things. They help actually fairly quickly.
We love bread in our house. I mean, who doesn't? PB&Js, turkey sandwiches, even just morning toast with butter. It's all good in our home. We're always on the hunt for a healthy alternative. That's why our family loves Hero Bread. It is delicious. They make delicious bread and products free of consequences or compromise. They've made carby, empty calorie bread products into fluffy, delicious versions that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories, plus protein and fiber. We love the classic white bread and the seeded bread, which are both made with olive oil and have a wonderful, rich taste to them. I was so surprised how soft both types of bread were. They were just the right blend of chewiness and sturdiness for making sandwiches. This bread is a favorite in our house for sure. The tortillas were also delicious, and we loved making simple cheese quesadillas as a snack. We're talking zero net carbs, high in fiber, 0 grams of sugar. What more could you ask for? Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code OUTSIDE at checkout. That's code OUTSIDE at HERO.CO.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play. And we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. You get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.
And this concept of, which I think is a really big one, how can a child preserve what they don't know? And that's what Paul Bogard talked about in The End of Night, which is if you have never seen the Milky Way, how do you even know that it exists and that you want to show your own kids? And so that was one of the concepts here, that children in the younger generations, they don't really have many experiences in nature. They may think negatively of the forest or the woods. And if we don't change their mindset now, there will be no chance. The best window for learning biophilia is before adolescence, the love of nature. What are your thoughts on that? It seems like a pretty big deal.
Well, apparently, there's kind of the sweet spot for kids in middle school. I think it's between about the ages of, 10 and 14, where they're particularly open to falling in love with the natural world. So they still have this kind of playful attitude outside. They'll still maybe do some of the things their parents or teachers are suggesting. They love animals. They're excited by what they're seeing out there. They love a little bit of adventure and risk taking. Their brains are still exploding. I mean, younger kids also, of course, love being outside. But I do. It makes sense to me that you know, if you try to really connect your kids to nature, you want to try to do it before high school because they will be more open to it. And then, of course, during high school, even if they loved nature when they were little, they'll probably go through this period where they're so peer focused and so phone focused. You know, that's okay, because somewhere in their little minds, they will remember that nature is their friend.
Yeah.
And they will go back to it, you know, in times of stress or when they are looking for some comfort outside, they'll go back to it when they're older.
Mm-hmm. You had a lot of information in this book about other places where they do school differently. And you talked about how kindergarten was originally meant to be this absorption of all the senses, kind of like all of these things that we're talking about. And there was a sentence that said, schools that are boring and not engaging will end up costing parents and taxpayers millions when these children are teens, because they're supposed to be learning. This was a hazard assessment. It's not risk avoidance, hazard assessment. And I like that wording. But we really are cutting down on recess. And 10 to 14, we're talking about middle school. I mean, I had no recess in middle school. Seems like it would be nice, though.
Yes. On any given day in the United States, I think, you know, something like 30% of sixth graders or something do not have recess. Mm-hmm. And we know that there's kind of a racial equity issue there. You know, more Black kids do not have recess. More city kids don't have recess. We know that in recess, during recess, during time outside, they are learning these kind of soft skills that they will need to succeed in life. You know, things like getting along with each other, you know, face-to-face interaction, teamwork, role-playing, free play, stuff that they do that's unstructured outside. Those are the skills that are going to help them later on. And, you know, my generation grew up with that every day. And the difference between parents today and their kids today and time outside and grandparents and their grandkids and time outside, you know, each generation is spending exponentially less time outside.
Right.
And it's really making a difference, we think, in terms of how kids are able to just handle, you know, a little bit of stress, handle a little bit of discomfort. When you're outside, you're learning that not everything is comfortable all the time. Hmm. You're learning that sometimes there are tense social interactions and you sort of learn how to deal with them. I think so many parents today are trying to make their kids' lives, you know, very wrinkle-free. Mm. And it turns out that we're not really doing them any favors by that.
Sure. You talked about the other countries like Finland and Scandinavia. Finland outdoor play is integrated into the day to an astonishing degree. A quarter of the time was spent outside. It was like 15 minutes per every hour.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Well, Finland, you know, has the highest test scores in the world. It's always in the top three. And all of these scholars and, you know, pundits are sort of thinking about why this is. And they say, oh, it's because the teachers make so much money, or because, you know, they're so well trained, and it's because the kids are well behaved. If you ask the teachers, they say, oh, no. It's just that we let them run around for 15 minutes every single hour.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they wouldn't sit still and they wouldn't learn anything.
Well, and then you talk in the book so many times it comes up about how exercise is actually helping the brain. So that's for the kids too. I mean, it's helpful for older adults. Exercise protects the brain from cognitive decline and aging. So that's great for all of us. It's the single best way to prevent aging-related cognitive decline is exercise. It has new brain cells growing and memory and executive function and spatial perception. But the sentence is, human brains seem to grow best when they get some time outside. So this is for our kids. I mean, yeah, it makes sense. 15 minutes on the hour. You related that to a story with your son who wasn't having recess for certain reasons. And they were like, well, the halls would get too muddy.
Yeah, they were like, it's too muddy outside. We don't want them going outside. Meanwhile, this school is like giving the kids iPads. I'm like, why don't you just give them some cheap galoshes, right?
Seriously,
they actually have higher test scores if you give them rain boots than if you give them iPads.
What a funny thing. So much cheaper too, wouldn't it be?
Yeah,
that's a really interesting piece for us, because then it's like, well, where's all that money going and who is at the head of that
and who is benefiting from that, right?
Yeah. So yeah, I love that the book includes so many things about how really it's the little things that can add up. It says within 200 milliseconds, people react positively when they see images of nature. 200 milliseconds. So obviously, you know, you say like more nature, you're going to feel better. But, you know, even some nature, you're going to feel good. You had a couple people that wove through the book, Frederick Olmsted. He was throughout the whole thing.
He's one of my heroes.
Because you're kind of following in his footsteps, right? Which is, he was this pioneer for getting people outside and the sort of way our cities look and are structured. And, you know, you're in the footsteps of that, right? You're writing a book about similar things.
Oh, that's kind of you to say. I think he was very, you know, he was a landscaper in the mid 19th century. And he designed Central Park, among many other parks. And he also advocated for national parks like Yosemite. He really understood that parks are important for our mental health. They're important for recovering from stress and illness. And he also knew that they were important for democracy, because these were large public spaces where, you know, we interacted with people who were different from us. And, you know, had a good time out there. And so I think he was really, really a valuable thinker, and maybe isn't even appreciated as much as he should be now.
Yes. You appreciated him, though, because he was in just about every chapter of this book. Roger Ulrich, same thing. It might be Ulrich, but our last name is Urich. So we say, but sometimes people say Urich. So I'm not quite sure if it's Ulrich or Ulrich.
Oh, right.
But you call him, there's like little quips in here too that I think are funny, Florence. It's like, you know, it's pretty serious material. But here and there, you just throw in, like you called him the hospital window guy. It's just like these little things that you threw in here and there. And I was like, oh, that's good. That's funny to weave all together. But he was talking about, well, first of all, what we see at our window. So it was the prisoners, you're in a hospital bed. And also that people would drive out of their way sometimes to go down a tree-lined road. So tell us about Roger.
Yeah, Roger, I believe he's a psychologist who teaches in an architecture school in Texas. And he did a really, really seminal study a while back that showed that people who all in a hospital who all got the same surgery, they all got a gallbladder surgery. And this was, I think the study took place over like 3 years. Some of them were assigned to hospital rooms that looked out onto a lawn and some trees. Others were assigned to a room that looked down to a brick wall. And the people who were assigned to the pretty window views ended up getting discharged from the hospital a day earlier.
Wow.
They requested less pain medication. Their nurses reported them as having sort of a better attitude toward healing. And philosophers and poets and other scientists have been writing about this for a long time. I mean, Florence Nightingale, you know, the nurse, noticed that when people were sick, they would turn their heads to the light, you know, almost like a plant.
Yeah.
That there's something just comforting and calming and healing about being able to look at life. You know, it makes sense.
Yeah. I loved that sentence in there, and I can't find it in my notes, but I definitely had written that one down from Florence, because she was saying, she said to me like, you know, this isn't proven, but I've had all of these different patients and they all turn their bodies to the light. We had stayed one time. Oh, I found it. It is. I liked how she said it. It is an unqualified result of all my experience with the sick that second to their need of fresh air is their need of light. So yeah, they lie with their faces turned to the light.
Yeah.
I stayed in an Airbnb once and the windows were up high. I'm not quite sure why it was designed like that, but you couldn't actually look outside. You were like looking up.
Mm.
And I just felt like so disconnected. I couldn't really handle it. So even that, you know, you're looking at life, but you just feel like you're disconnected from like the rhythm and what's going on in the day. And of course, I guess the light would change, but you just, I don't know. It really bothered me. It was odd.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's another kind of tip, you know, for your kids, you know, put their desks near a window, you know, encourage them to open their shades, right, when they're doing their homework or when they're hanging out.
Yeah.
It's good for them.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, so much in this book, The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. You can find more at florencewilliams.com. People can come on your Nature Fix retreats, which is a cool opportunity out in Colorado. What a great thing that you could do. You talk about different programs similar to yours in the book, like Outward Bound. And there was one for veterans called Higher Ground. So all of those programs, they make such a difference, you know, whether they're a couple days or a couple weeks or however long they are, really at changing people's view of their life and how things are going. So I so appreciate you coming on. Thank you for being here. Just a wonderful book filled with all things about happiness and feeling good and statistics. I mean, so many statistics in there. 70% of people sleep with their phone. The average person looks at their phone 150 times a day. You talk in here a lot about walking. So there's so much to learn. And Florence, we always end our podcast with the same question. And it's interesting, since you had all these experiences with your dad, I'm not sure what you'll say, but what was a favorite memory from your childhood that was outside?
Oh, wow. What a fun question. Thank you for asking. I remember an early river trip I took with my dad. I think it was just a day trip where we were canoeing down this river in West Virginia. And I remember there was a tree overhanging the river. And it was kind of at a low enough angle that as a little kid, I could sort of climb up this tree, climb up the incline. It was a big tree. And I thought that was very adventurous, you know, after growing up in the asphalt of New York, to climb this tree. And then we could jump off into the river. Wow. And, you know, it was such a thrill for me. And it made me feel, it just made me feel sort of powerful as a little girl, you know, that I could do this kind of brave athletic thing. And I think these outdoor sports for kids and probably especially for girls, where there, we know there's a bravery gap between boys and girls. If we can encourage our girls to, you know, go be athletic out there and jump around and climb the trees and feel their power, feel their strength, you know, what a gift for them.
Yeah, for sure. And West Virginia sure is beautiful. What a memory. Well, Florence, I so appreciate your book, all that you've written. It's incredible retreats that you're doing. What an opportunity for people. Thank you for taking your time to be here with us.
Thank you for having me, Ginny, and thank you for all you're doing for children.
No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, whew, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepardota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tidy humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode. So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us.